You're listening to a sermon by J. Evan Crider, recorded on Sunday, September 9th at the Point Grey Inter-Mennonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, see our privacy policy at pgimf.org. We apologize in advance for the poor quality of this particular recording.
You may as well get used to it. I'll ask that you turn off your cell phones. I know of one prophet UBC who keeps cell phones that ring during his lectures. Today I'm going to be speaking on the gospel reading, so if you would turn in your bulletins or in your Bibles to the Luke 14 chapter, that's going to be the focus of my thinking today. Today's gospel reading has phrases which have been heard so often that they've become safe rather than shocking. But originally they were very shocking. In today's gospel reading, Jesus is asking some enthusiastic tagalongs either to take unheard of risks or get lost. And if you're serious about being a Christian and take today's gospel reading seriously, it will change your life, no matter what point you are in your pilgrimage. So now I'm going to go through this point by point, verse 25. Now large crowds were traveling with him. Stop. Large crowds. That tells us that by now quite a few people are interested in what Jesus is doing. Some are tagging along because they're interested in maybe there'll be a miracle and they can be entertained. Maybe he'll get in an argument with some of the bigwigs in the temple and beat them intellectually. Ha! Because they have some arguments with the rich people in the temple too. So something's going to happen that they want to sort of watch and be part of. And Jesus is starting to realize that having a large group of people tag along everywhere he goes is diluting his ministry and his ability to think profoundly. And so I think verse 26 is not said very nicely. I think that Jesus has had it with the large crowd, and he turns on them and says in absolute frustration, "Whoever comes to me and does not hate father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, even life itself, cannot be my follower." Now this is very exclusive, and there's very little wiggle room. Of course I'm going to look for it, but there's very little wiggle room. Commentators all agree that the word hate in English isn't quite what it's about, but it means in essence you have to be willing to give family second place. Or to put it another way, family approval does not come before what you're going to do for your faith. And this is in tension with one of the Ten Commandments, honor thy father and thy mother. And so Jesus is proposing a very profound situation. How do you resolve that commandment with giving primacy to your faith? Because eventually, you and your parents are not going to agree. Believe me. My kids don't agree with me. They're dead wrong. And I don't agree with my parents, and they're also wrong. Well, you're lucky I'm talking. In the context of the earlier part of Luke 14, which we didn't read, Jesus had just given the example of really respectable rich people giving a meal and not everyone coming. And so go out into the street and make everyone come into this meal. The street people, the beggars, we would say the druggies, have them all come in. Now, this is not going to meet with family approval. And in fact, Jesus did not meet with family approval. He started out in his dad's construction company in Nazareth. Nazareth was booming. trade route. There was a lot of construction going on. I suspect Jesus came from a wealthy family. And he leaves the business probably at the time when his dad expected Jesus to take it over. And you remember another story where Jesus' mother comes and his brothers, and they try to get him to stop his ministry. And then he asks, well, who is my mother? Who are my brothers? These are my mother, my brothers. So Jesus himself was putting his calling ahead of family approval. Verse 27. Whoever does not carry the cross and follow me cannot be my disciple. Modern Christians feel very comfortable with the cross. We have lots of crosses here. Helmut has given us two very nice ones. It's rugged, but safe. I could never get on that. This one is more stylized, just plain lines, and very safe. I saw a jewelry cross over here. We're willing to wear crosses as jewelry. The cross has become utterly safe for us. It takes a little different kind of personality to wear a little pendant of an electric chair or something like that. That's what the cross meant. And remember, Jews hearing this just had experienced Israel all being shocked by the Romans crucifying a lot of Jews at one time for rebellion. And the rebellion was a religious one. And this is so recently, just a few years earlier, that taking up the cross meant something to them in a religious context. Whoever does not carry the cross and follow me cannot be my disciple. Jesus is really asking, are you willing to follow me, putting your pursuit of philosophy, your pursuit of theology, ahead of family approval, and even risk your own life? Now, we've all read the rest of Luke, I think, and we know the answer is no. The large crowd disappears. Peter hangs on to the very end, but then he tries to weasel out and tries to disassociate himself with Jesus. This, are you willing to take up the cross, is a kind of crux that very few people are willing to do. I'll be honest, I'm not willing to do it. There's no way I'm going next week to Afghanistan to take the place of the Korean missionaries who were killed. Am I therefore not a follower? Verse 28. For which of you, intending to build a tower, does not first sit down and estimate the cost, to see whether you have enough to complete it? Well, Jesus, the construction guy, develops the theme of counting the cost. It's an obvious illustration from a contractor. Before you start to build a house or a high rise, make sure you can afford to finish it. This is a very obvious illustration to Jesus people. It's less obvious to the United States. Reading about all the foreclosures recently, thousands and thousands and thousands of foreclosures, so much so that economic analysts are starting to compare our debt load now with the debt load preceding the big crash in the Depression. I have no idea how much UBC pension is dependent on those bad debts, but I'll be finding out, I'm sure. Jesus is not arguing against zero financing. Jesus and everybody just assumed nobody would be that stupid. And so what Jesus is saying really is, before you take up the cross, count the cost to make sure you understand what you are doing. Before you rush into your dad like I did and resign from the construction business, or see your boss and say, that's it, I'm going to do something else now for the church. Think it through. Don't be instantaneous and emotional about it. make sure this is something you can carry through on, just as surely as you would want to finish building a house that you start. Verse 31, another very logical story. Or what king going out to wage a war against another king will not sit down first and consider whether he is able, with 10,000, to oppose the one who comes against him with 20,000? If he cannot, then while the other king is still far away, he sends a delegation and sues for peace. Well, this story would have reminded the Jews listening to Jesus of Herod Antipas. Interesting character. Herod was married, but that didn't prevent him from getting the hots for Herodias. Unfortunately, he couldn't contain himself, and so he divorced his wife so he could marry Herodias. John the Baptist, then you remember, speaks out against this. Herodias is not amused, and she asks for his head on a platter. At least he wasn't crucified. Herod Antipas made a mistake when he got a divorce, because his first wife had a father who was also a king like Herod, and he had an army. So he sent his army against Herod Antipas, and his army beat Herod's army, and Herod had to sue for peace. The divorce cost him dearly. He had an army of soldiers rather than our modern method, which is an army of lawyers. Everyone realized, yep, Herod had not counted the cost before he undertook that divorce. Verse 33. So therefore, none of you can become my disciple if you do not give up all your possessions. Now, this is an abrupt ending. This is an attention getter. And in some ways, I find it a non sequitur. I find it just doesn't quite follow. And I can see several ways to become comfortable with it. Not with the idea itself, but just with the sequence of ideas. One is that Jesus gives these stories about father and mother, cross, building, counting the cost before you go to the war. And is getting pushback from some in the large crowd who don't want to take it that seriously. They want to be entertained, or they want a kind of faith that doesn't cost them that heavily. They just want to belong, but not really sacrifice. And maybe Jesus, in absolute frustration, just turns to them and says, look, get rid of your possessions, and force them to think. Or maybe he is saying, okay, if you're willing to take following me so seriously that if your family objects, you'll still stay with it. If your life is in danger, you'll still stay with it. If it's going to bring economic ruin to you and your family, you'll still risk it. Okay, get started. And the first thing you do is get rid of your possessions. The crowd's not going to stay large very long. Now, some reflections. My first reflection goes back to the psalm that Don read. O Lord, you have searched me and known me. You discern my thoughts from far away and are acquainted with all my ways. I may be able to fool myself about how serious I am about my faith, my discipleship, my money, my time. But God knows the real situation. The second reflection is, unfortunately, more complicated, especially the way I do it. Jesus' words about discipleship were truly extreme. If religion is supposed to come before high school studies, if religion and faith are supposed to come before university studies, how in the world do you graduate? How do you become a good steward of the money that you're borrowing to study, to buy your books, which aren't cheap, you're finding out, and to pay for your living and housing while you're studying? These are intention. And so ultimately, very few people actually follow Jesus in this way. Ultimately, most Christians, most churches ignore these verses, or they pass over them rather quickly. I have long suspected, but I cannot prove, that churches which ask relatively little of members become large churches. And churches which place heavy emphasis on discipleship are destined to remain small. For instance, some churches, by the example of enough of their members, put pressure on others to give money sacrificially, way beyond 10%. You just sort of sense others that you're worshiping with do this. And that kind of church isn't going to be very large. Or again, by the example of enough members in the church, people are expected, as their health permits, to give a lot of time to church, charity, health, societal concerns. And not just be a backbencher, not just be an attender, but to give evenings, to give quite a bit. Now, I'm proud to say on both scores, our church does very well. I feel all kinds of pressure. But I can resist. Today's worship service welcomes and celebrates students, and so now I want to address students. The rest of you can relax. UBC asks its most serious students to avoid easy questions, and to avoid ever thinking you have finally found an answer and can therefore set that question aside. UBC asks you to use your intellect at a world-class level. Our little congregation, which relates to people interested in education, asks its attendees to sacrifice easy questions and cozy answers. And we are convinced that one way we can encourage students to do this is by creating this center in which students can live as a community and they can grow and probe each other. We don't want there to be a gulf between your intellect, your intellectual inquiry at UBC, and the intellectual inquiry related to your faith. Don't ever let, whatever church you go to, including ours, don't ever let a pastor trick you into bringing your intellect down to his level. Don't ever do that. God gave you an intellect. Keep it up there, whether it's physics, computer science, or something that actually takes thinking, like literature or music history. People are awake. I think it's time for a song. I remember attending a church, not this one, and the pastor handed out a sheet of questions related to the sermon. And he was convinced, as was his congregation apparently, that each question was answered by the next verse in the passage. It was unbelievably bad. The intellectual content of that sermon was at about the level of the shopping channel. don't let there be a gulf between the growth in your intellectual thinking, in your discipline, and your faith. Nurture your faith and see if the kind of questions you were asking at UBC can be applied or help you think better with your faith. And don't drop to the common denominator of those who are not thinking. You see, nobody asked harder questions than Jesus did. In fact, the church, the best minds in Christianity, have been struggling with the questions Jesus asked for 2,000 years. I once had a teacher, and he told us in a graduate seminar, God forgive him, he said, you guys are going to go out and be profs, and someday your students are going to ask you a question, and you're not going to know the answer. Answer the question. Your students should never, ever suspect you don't have the answer to your question that's asked, because they expect you to have those answers. Thereafter, I never believed the thing the guy said. And it's the same in faith. If somebody has the answers quickly, on the tip of their tongue, to every question Jesus asked, that person isn't thinking. Because the disciples couldn't answer it. St. Andrew, St. James, St. Peter, St. Paul. Who the heck do we think we are that we can answer them just like that? The questions Jesus posed are so profound that we keep working on them. And we understand the questions in new ways. And we grow theologically by grappling with these questions. And the question Jesus is asking today is, what constitutes discipleship? Approval? Financial sacrifice? Time? Risk of life? What constitutes knowing you have the right faith? At what point can you call yourself my follower? Sell all your possessions? This guy's not going to do that. I'm not willing to part with one of my four phones at home, or either of our cell phones. The only computer I'm going to part with is the one that doesn't work. So I'm not at that point. I'm not going to turn over my pension to the poor. Sorry. What do we do with these questions? And so the question does not have a facile answer. But what we hope is that all of us, those who have gone to school, those who enjoy reading, those who enjoy thinking, grapple with these questions. Remember, Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. Nobody comes to the Father except by me. And what I think Jesus meant is, I am the way. The two main things Jesus did. He looked after people's physical needs. He looked after them as individuals, as people. And the other thing he did is he looked after their minds, and he pushed their religious thinking, and he pushed their intellect, he pushed their minds to the highest level. If he wasn't healing somebody or feeding somebody or entertaining somebody, he was talking theology. He would travel from one village to the other, yap, yap, yap. He would be a guest somewhere, and he just couldn't help himself. He'd be talking theology. He'd be at a meal, he'd be talking theology. He'd be sitting on a mountain, he'd be talking theology. He was obsessed with learning about God and trying to figure out what is faith about. Jesus, students, gave you minds, gave you intellects. One of the verses we sang was, take my silver and my gold, not a mite would I withhold. Take my intellect and use every power as thou shalt choose. Let's pray. Lord, I am your follower. Help me to be a more disciplined follower. Lord, you gave us all the ability to help others. Give us new insights in how we can do this, given our health, our time, and our resources. Lord, you gave us the ability to read and to think. Help us to be more disciplined thinkers so that we can become more like you. Our way to truth, our way to real life.